I stop and consider the number of congregations that you have within the greater Bowling Green area, I'm somewhat envious. We have 125,000 people in the Bloomington-Normal area. That's within the city limits of those two communities. The entire county, McLean County, is roughly between 200 and 225,000 people. And to our knowledge, there is one non-institutional group, which is us, in that entire county. And we will generally have between 75 and 85 people present on at any given assembly when everyone's in town. When State Farm decides to send some of their people to other parts of the country, our attendance generally takes a pretty good hit because we have 10 breadwinners who currently are employed at State Farm corporate headquarters. And it's not unusual for two or three of them to be gone at any one given point in time. And I say all that to say this. I had a friend back in the late 70s who moved from central Illinois down to Athens, Alabama. He thought he was moving to the land that flowed with milk and honey when it came to the presence of Christians and churches. He was down there about 4 or 5 months, and I called him up and wondered how he was doing and how he was acclimating himself. Not too long into the conversation, he said, "I have to stop you because I have to tell you that there are giants in the land." And that wasn't a complimentary thing from his point of view. He was, in his own polite and not so subtle way, telling me that there are problems down there just like there are everywhere else. And as a matter of fact, from his point of view, they were even magnified. We're going to talk about a giant tonight. You picked up the headlines in Saul's day. It might have been something like this: Goliath defies the army of Saul. That would have been your headline for the Israeli Times in the year 1020, roughly, BCE. Children love this story. Quite frankly, adults do too. And we understand that that's true when we think about the movies that are among our favorites. I'm going to make a confession here that I made to a few last night. And I was actually sending out feelers when I did that. One of my favorite movies of all time is Rudy. Part of that has to do with the fact that I grew up just not too far from the University of Notre Dame. I grew up a Notre Dame fan. I still am a Notre Dame fan. But if you've seen the movie Rudy, you know here's a little runt of a kid who has a dream. He's no bigger, no taller than I am. And at that particular point in time in his life, weighed considerably less than I do. And his dream was to play football at the University of Notre Dame. He was a runt among giants. And he finally gets his day in the sun. He finally gets on the field. He finally gets to play a game, and the whole movie is about the struggle that he went through to accomplish that dream and playing that game. But that theme is played over and over and over again in movie after movie after movie after movie. Think about Robert Redford in The Natural, overcoming incredible odds. The Rookie, about the pitcher for the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, who comes back from surgery, is told he's never going to pitch again, and at the age of 38, he makes it back to the major leagues and pitches for another year plus. All of those have this theme running through them of someone overcoming insurmountable odds, facing giant obstacles in their life, and succeeding. And it's no wonder children love this story. I do have one bone to pick. It's not with y'all specifically, as much as it is with our songwriters and our Bible class literature preparers. I don't think David was a little boy. I think David was probably between the ages of 16 and 18. Now, Saul calls him a boy. I imagine Goliath looked at him like, "You're just like a mosquito on my nose somewhere." But he probably wasn't the little boy we often think of, who at 8 or 9 years old was tending his daddy's sheep. We know he wasn't a fighting age, or he may well have been with the army at that particular point in time. But the likelihood of him being a small boy as we think of most of the children who went to class being, I don't think David was. But this story has all of these wonderful elements that make up a wonderful tale to tell. It has action. It has intrigue. And it even gets gory at a point when David decides Goliath is losing his head. And he takes Goliath's sword and removes his own head from his body. The underdog wins, which is something else that we like. And so it's no surprise that this event in biblical history ranks right up there as one of the all-time favorites. It's been made into at least 4 major motion pictures. Not too many of the biblical stories have been turned into major motion pictures, but this one has on at least 4 occasions. But what we're going to do tonight as we take a closer look at this story is we're going to look at 3 things. We're going to look at the story through the eyes of the world, through the eyes of Goliath and Saul. You might say, well, Saul's not of the world. Well, by this point in time in his life and in this particular instance, he's not looking at this event. He's not looking at this circumstance with the eyes of God. So we're going to put him in that camp. We're going to then, after we look at the Philistine perspective and the Israel perspective, we're going to look at this event through the eyes of God as witnessed by David. And then at the conclusion, what I want to do is spend just a little time asking you how you see your world. What giants do you face? And how are you going to deal with them? Because we all face them. Some of them are nothing more than figments of our imagination. We blow up the problem to these huge proportions and wonder how we'll ever defeat this thing in front of us that has taken on a life of its own and we don't know what to do about it. Well, I'm hopeful that we'll have at least the courage to face it, even if we don't have all the tools or all the knowledge with respect to how after we're done this evening. So I want us to take a look at these events, first of all, through the eyes of Goliath, through the eyes of Saul. And let's start in 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 1. As two armies come together, pitting themselves against one another, the text tells us, now the Philistines gathered their forces for war and assembled at Succah in Judah. They pitched a camp at Ephes-Damim between Succah and Azekah. Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up their battle line to meet the Philistines. Philistia inhabits the territory west of Israel. And since it's west of Israel, it's on the coast of the Mediterranean. It can't, no expansion to the west because all there is water to the west. So the only way that it can expand its borders is by going north, south, or east. And it likes the land to the east. To the east is Israel, obviously. It accompanies or occupies this very fertile Jordan River Valley, which is why it was so attractive and why it was called a land that flowed with milk and honey. It was some of the most fertile ground known to man. These two nations had been warring over that part of the world off and on for a few hundred years at this particular point in time, and neither one of them has been able to completely dominate or eliminate the other. It's been a battle that both sides rise and wane throughout the course of history so far as they attempt to expand their territory and to dominate the region. And that whether they rose or fell usually depended upon their leader at that particular time and the ability of that leader. At least that's how it's seen from the world's perspective. And this particular battle is not going to be a whole lot different. In our text, we see that the Philistines have entered into Israelite territory. In particular, they have entered the territory that belongs to Judah, but it's very close to the border of Benjamin. As a matter of fact, this particular battle is going to take place right where that circle is on this particular map. If I've been able to piece together from several different sources, I couldn't find one source that gave it to me exactly, and so I utilized this particular map and drew the circle about where this was going to happen. And that's going to be significant in just a moment. Don't forget how close, even though they're in Judah, remember how close this is to Benjamin at this particular point in time. We'll come back to that later, though we won't come back to the map. The Philistines are looking to increase their territory and to place the Israelites into subjection. And they're feeling pretty confident about their particular circumstance on this occasion. They think they have the upper hand against the Israelites. And the reason for their confidence lies in a champion that has arisen, quite literally, among them. You and I know him as Goliath. A name that has, since this point in time, always been associated with someone who is tall and large in stature. Look at verse 3 through 7 of 1 Samuel 17. The Philistines occupied one hill, the Israelites another, with the valley between them. A champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. He was over 9 feet tall. He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he wore a coat of scale armor of bronze weighing 5,000 shekels. On his legs he wore bronze greaves, and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod, and its iron point weighed 600 shekels. His shield bearer went ahead of him. This man, his immenseness, if you'll allow me to create a word if it didn't already exist, was enough to inspire the Philistines to believe, okay, we can have the upper hand in this. We feel somewhat invincible. As a matter of fact, we're going to go so far as to say, we'll send out our champion, Goliath, and we want you to send out your champion, and we'll do a little one-on-one here. And whichever one of our champions wins, those people will then become the rulers of the territory. The losers will become subordinate. How many of you remember Rocky IV? Isn't that sort of the process here after Rocky defeats the mean and huge Russian Drago? His speech at the end is, you know, why can't we settle all of our worldly disputes in this fashion? Well, that's what the Philistines are proposing on this particular occasion. By the way, that's another one of those plot lines that's similar to this. You know, here's Rocky, the smallest, 6 foot, 205 pound, taking on the big Drago who's 6'4 or 6'6 and outweighs Rocky by about 75, 80 pounds and not even supposed to be able, Rocky's not supposed to last a round, but he ends up winning. Philistines believe the gods, their gods are smiling on them on this particular occasion, looking down favorably upon them, and victory is pretty certain from their point of view. They're going to finally dominate these people, the Israelites, and their God. I believe that's how the Philistine army viewed this. The sad point in all of this is that the Israelite army seemed to view it similarly, didn't they? Goliath had the desired effect on the army of Israel. Israel had allowed themselves to be intimidated by Goliath. And no wonder. Think about those details again that we've read here on the screen and recall them. How tall is this man? Have you ever seen anyone this tall? By the way, I stood next to the actor who played Ivan Drago. He was happened to be in the airport same time I was. He's not 6 foot six. He's barely 6 foot tall. And they could get away with saying he was 6 foot six because Sylvester Stallone isn't 6 foot tall. Sylvester Stallone's just maybe a half an inch taller than I am. And so they could get by with those kind of figures in the movie because proportionally there were some similarities. But I've stood next to some pretty tall folks. And I felt rather small in standing next to folks who are 6'6 and 6'7 and 6'8. That's why I changed from playing basketball when I was in high school to ice hockey. You know, I've been this tall since seventh grade. So I started on my seventh grade basketball team as a guard. Eighth grade, I was coming off the bench. In ninth grade, I'm sitting most of the time. And by the time I got to the tenth grade, I was on the reserve team, and I was tired of having Spalding tattooed across my forehead every time I drove the lane. So I switched to hockey. ice skates and ice are a great equalizer. And it doesn't matter how big your opponent is. If you know how to use a stick and you know how to pull a jersey over somebody's head, you have the upper hand. And I learned that rather quickly. I led my team in penalty minutes. I'll just finish this story so you know that I really did change. Or the Lord changed me. But I led the team in penalty minutes. So I've now become a Christian in between seasons. And I don't know what I'm going to do, but it's a new season start, and I play the first game. First game of that season, 2 minutes into the game, I'm finding myself in my usual place. You know what that's called in hockey, by the way? The nickname for the penalty box? It's called the sin bin. Isn't that ironic? And there I find myself sitting. 2 minute penalty for roughing, a 5 minute penalty for fighting, and a 10 minute misconduct because I said some choice words to the referee who gave me the more penalty minutes than the fellow I just beat to a pulp. So after the game was over, I folded up my uniform and took it to the coach, and I said, I can't do this anymore. I can't play. I'm a Christian, and that was not the kind of display that should have been evidenced by all of you and by the audience. And until I can control that, I can't play anymore. And I handed him my equipment. When I came out of the locker room and my father saw, my father's not a Christian even to this day, my father saw that I didn't have all of my equipment with me. He asked me what I'd done. He had spent several thousand dollars that summer sending me to Canada for hockey school. And he was heartbroken, didn't speak to me for about 2 or 3 weeks. Because of my walking away from that. And I didn't play hockey again until I was 27 years old. And you know what I found out? I found out you can do some rather remarkable things the longer you stay on the ice. I went from leading my high school team in penalty minutes to leading my rec league team in scoring because I found a way to stay on the ice. So I said all that simply to let you know, number one, what God can do in the life of someone. The credit for that change doesn't belong to me. It belongs to the God who works mightily in me, who can do more than, we talked about this last night, more than we can ask or imagine. The same God who equips David to ultimately win this battle is the same God who changes me and who changes you. And who helps us deal with the demons in our life or the giants in our life, whatever the case may be. Unfortunately, Israel sees Goliath much the same way the Philistines do. He's intimidating. He's taller than Shaquille O'Neal. Shaquille O'Neal is probably the best person I could get to kind of try and illustrate this. And Goliath is 2 feet taller and who knows how much broader than Shaquille O'Neal was. I saw a picture one time in a magazine that showed two men silhouetted. It doesn't tell you who they are at first. And then it only tells, and one of them just dwarfs the other. And then they show you the first man who's in front and who's being dwarfed by the second. You know who the first man is? Arnold Schwarzenegger. And the second man standing behind him who dwarfs him is Shaquille O'Neal. My guess is David wasn't as big as Arnold Schwarzenegger by any measurement. Height, breadth, size of arms. But if you would have taken Shaquille O'Neal and put him in front of Goliath, you might have seen the same kind of proportional difference. And now eliminate Shaquille O'Neal and you have Goliath and you have anyone in Israel who is just dwarfed by the size of this man. I would have ventured to guess that this man is not only tall and broad, but he's strong. You realize the spear on the end of his, that spearhead on the end of his spear weighed roughly 15 to 20 pounds by itself? Multiply that figure by almost 10, and that may have been how much his armor weighed that he wore as he walked around. He was just by functioning as a soldier, he was lifting weights and building up muscle mass on a regular basis. This is not somebody you want to mess with. And he's a trained soldier. He's not just some freak of nature. While he is a freak of nature, he's more than that. He's a trained killer. And the Philistines used him well to gain a psychological advantage in this battle with Israel. But let's look at Saul for just a moment. I think it's important. He's the leader of these people. The people of Israel. He's their king. And remember why he was chosen king? Remember some things about him? Let's go back for just a moment to 1 Samuel chapter 9. We want to know where he's from, first of all, something about his family, and then we'll note something about him. 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 1, there was a Benjamite, a man of standing, whose name was Kish, son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Becherath, the son of Aphiah of Benjamin. He comes from Benjamin. Remember earlier we talked about how close this is taking place to Benjamin? There's the reason I want you to remember that. Saul's from Benjamin. This battle's taking place in his backyard. He's got a home to defend. Not only does he have the honor of his God to defend, and not only does he have his kingdom to defend, they're fighting this in his backyard. I don't know if you can say fighting a war on your territory really is like home court or home field advantages in sports. Usually when the enemy is on your territory, that doesn't speak too well for the prospects of your battle. You've already made some huge tactical errors if the enemy's already encroached upon your land. Well, they're about to do that with respect to Saul's home turf. It's being endangered. But now notice, he comes from a family that has some standing. At least his father has some standing. But Saul must have had some standing of his own. This man, Kish, had a son named Saul, an impressive young man, without equal among the Israelites, a head taller than any of the others. I imagine he was a man of some standing. He was more impressive than any of the other of the Israelites, without equal. He's described as being at least a head taller than any of the others, and that would have included David, and that's important in just a little bit as we look at David's preparing for this battle. So, in one sense, doesn't Israel have their giant too? Here he stands a head taller than everyone else. And he stood a head taller not just because of his physical height, but I believe he was a giant among Israel because of how the people viewed him, a man of standing, impressive, without equal. So what do we find him doing, this impressive one among the Israelites, the man who stood head and shoulders, some translations say, above all of the people that he governed and ruled? Where do we find him when this Philistine comes challenging them? Well, let's look at verse 11. On hearing the Philistines' words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. The giant of Israel, a man who stood head and shoulders above all of his brethren, a man who was impressive and of whom it said that there was no equal, is dismayed and terrified. Israel, all of Israel, at least all of those fighting men who witnessed this giant coming out taunting them on a daily basis for 40 days, is terrified of him as well. Saul's probably 2 to 3 feet shorter than Goliath. And he was probably outmatched by about 100 pounds of muscle. And not even Saul's promise of tremendous wealth, his own daughter in marriage, and living tax-free among God's people could entice any of his soldiers, any of his best fighting men, to take on Goliath in a duel. Because they all are convinced none of us stand a chance against this man. Well, except one man. We don't have time to look at all the background, but David enters the scene. He was the son of an Ephraimite named Jesse, who was in Bethlehem in Judea, according to verse 12 of chapter 17. Jesse had 8 sons, of which David was the 8th. Jesse's 3 oldest sons were here with Saul, preparing for battle against the Philistines, but none of them were stepping forward and saying, okay, enough is enough. We'll take on, or I'll take on the Philistine. No, they don't do that. But David, the youngest, comes to the camp after having attended his father's sheep. His father sends him with some nourishment for his brothers and to see how they are. Now, before we look at David through God's eyes or at this event through David's eyes, and I want to suggest to you that looking at this event through David's eyes is seeing this event through the eyes of God. Let's look at David through the eyes of the Philistine and through the eyes of Saul. We'll look through the eyes of Saul first. David's young, probably between the ages of 6 to 18, and he's not fully developed as a man yet. I know some of you who may be sitting in here who are 16 to 18 are saying, how dare you suggest I'm not fully developed as a man yet? Well, that's why National Football League teams let you go to college for 4 years. And that's why the National Basketball Association would prefer not taking you before the age of 19. And that's why the military, even though they get you at 18, you don't look the same coming out of the military as you did going in, because there's still some more development that needs to take place. I'm suggesting to you that that's the case with David. He's not fully developed yet. He's still growing. And we're helped to this conclusion by something that Saul does. When he finally says, okay, David, go ahead. You can go and fight him. On one hand, what else? Saul doesn't have anything to lose other than his armor bearer. He says, go ahead and go. But look at what he does. Saul dressed David in his own tunic. He put a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened on his sword over the tunic and tried walking around because he was not used to them. I cannot use these, he said to Saul, because I'm not used to them. So he took them off. I want to suggest to you that it was more than just not used to them. They didn't fit. If this is Saul's armor, and Saul's a head taller, he's probably broader, he's a mature man, this stuff just isn't going to work. How many of you who take athletics seriously like to use used equipment? Somebody else's equipment. I know one thing. When I played hockey, I couldn't use somebody else's stick. I cut mine so that it fit my body size. I bent my blade within legal limits so that I was used to my stick. I couldn't use somebody else's stick and do what I could do with my own. I couldn't use somebody else's skates. They didn't fit my feet right. I don't like to this day playing baseball with somebody else's glove or using someone else's bat. David says, this stuff doesn't fit. I'm not used to it. I don't want to use it. From the world's perspective, from even Saul's perspective, who calls him a boy, David really is not equipped to deal with this. I think Saul put this armor on him to try and help him understand that point, to help him see, you can't do this. But David is not convinced. Look at what David's brothers say about him in chapter 17. Chapter 17, verse 28. David's oldest brother hears David. And he hears David speaking with the man, and he burned with anger at him and asked, why have you come down here? And with whom did you lead those few sheep in the desert? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down here only to watch the battle. David's brothers view him as a nuisance, a pain in the neck, view him as obnoxious. Saul said this to him in, I don't have that slide. In verse 33, notice what Saul says to him. You are not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. You are only a boy. And he has been a fighting man from his youth. So Saul, David's brothers, I imagine most of the army that Saul has around who's overheard David or encountered David on this occasion are shaking their head in dismay and wonderment. He's seen as a naive young man whose naivete has made him outgrow his britches. He's a dreamer. But Saul decides, I'm not going to deny the boy his dream. And so he allows him to go to battle. He looked David over and saw that he was only a boy. Actually, Goliath looks him over on this occasion. Goliath now, as David stands in front of him, viewed David as a boy, ruddy and handsome, and he despised him. He said to David, "Am I a dog that you come out to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. "Come here," he said, "and I'll give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field." After 40 or more days of going out every morning and every night, challenging everyone in Israel to this death match, finally someone shows up. Finally, someone has the courage to come out and to face me, Goliath is thinking, until he sees who it is. In his mind, it's a boy. A kid with a big mouth. I want you to picture both of these guys, you know, as dogs. Goliath has thrown out the charge, you think of me as a dog and you come at me with a stick. I want you to think of Goliath as a bull mastiff. Now, those are huge dogs. They used to be used to take down bulls in the ancient world. And they can grow up to 200 or more pounds. And they're vicious. And then there's David. And I think to get the picture right, David is going to have to end up being a little chihuahua. All bark, no bite. At least that's how he's viewed by Goliath. It'd be foolish for him to try and attack Goliath on this occasion. And I think the world would have viewed it that way as well. So you've seen the scene from the perspective of Saul. There's not much hope for success here. From the perspective of Goliath, you've sent out a boy to do a man's job. This is like breaking a twig to me. What's the point? There's a disdain for David, a disdain for Israel that existed before, and that has even grown now that Israel's champion is this young man who's still wet behind the ears, who's too big for his britches, however you want to phrase it, from the perspective of all the people who are watching this at this particular point in time. But now let's look at the contest from the eyes of David and the eyes of God. And the first thing that would not have set well in heaven and doesn't set well with David is the fact that these people, these Philistines, continue to exist in the first place. And how dare they set foot in Judah, in the land that God had promised His people Israel. Go back to Numbers chapter 33. Beginning with verse 51, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into Canaan, drive out all the inhabitants of the land before you, destroy all their carved images and their cast idols, and demolish all their high places. Take possession of the land and settle it, for I have given you the land to possess. Distribute the land by lot according to your clans. To a larger group, give a larger inheritance. To a smaller group, a smaller one. Whatever falls to them by lot will be theirs, distributed according to your ancestral tribes. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land, those who you allow to remain will become barbs in your eyes and thorns in your sides. They will give you trouble in the land where you live." God had told them as they took this possession of this land to utterly destroy all of these peoples, and they haven't done it. And now they're coming back to haunt them. What are they doing here? They do not have a right to be here. And as David has put it, these uncircumcised heathens ought not to be allowed to get away with what's happening. Verse 26 of chapter 17 of 1 Samuel, David asked the men standing near him, "What will be done for the man who kills the Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel?" He recognizes what an affront to the God of heaven this is and what a disgrace this is to his people. "Who is," David asked, "this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? This is holy ground. It belongs to the Lord and to his people. Why hasn't someone stepped up, stepped forward, and dealt with this man?" The offense is compounded by Goliath's taunting, by his cursing David, by his gods. How can this be allowed? To David, this isn't just about territory. This is about honor. The honor of his God and the honor of his people. This is about truth. Why isn't anyone standing up to this man? Why isn't anyone standing up to the truth that we serve the God of heaven above and of earth below? Where are the men in Israel? Is what David really is asking. Doesn't anyone know that when you fight for the Lord, you fight with the Almighty, the one who created the universe and upholds it by His hand? You go with His strength and His might. Notice what David says to Goliath in chapter 17, verse 45, beginning, "You come against me with a sword and a spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will hand you over to me, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. Today I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and He will give all of you into our hands." Who was Goliath as far as God is concerned? As significant as we've tried to establish the contrast between Goliath and David, we can't even begin to illustrate the contrast between God and Goliath. Our minds can't comprehend such a vast difference. Goliath is nothing. He's like the flea on the chihuahua to God, I guess, if we're going to try and go from the ridiculous to the sublime. This is how David views his world. David views his world in terms of right and wrong, and this is wrong. This should not be allowed. And is somebody going to have the courage to stand up and do something about it? David sees his world in terms of good and evil. We need to see our world this way, folks. We need to develop an us against them attitude, or we're going to have tremendous difficulty in the wicked world in which we live. David sees the world in terms of black and white. And this Goliath, this so-called champion of the Philistines, he is wrong, he is evil, and we need to deal with him. That's the world through David's eyes. That's this particular event through the eyes of David. So what was Goliath to David? What was Goliath to God? Well, when you see the world properly, when you see the world through God's eyes, you understand that Goliath is nothing. But what about your world? How do you see your world? How do you see our world? Who is presently barking at you and causing you to become dismayed, terrified? Allow me just the remaining few moments to put whatever is giving you reason to be dismayed or terrified into proper perspective. And I want to do that by looking at Jesus for just a moment. Because I believe Jesus once faced some very formidable foes. Some formidable champions of this world. He once faced the principalities and powers of this dark world. He faced Satan himself. Not just in the three temptations where they eyeballed each other and stood toe to toe and Satan would throw his fiery dart and Jesus would deal with it by quoting the Word of God back to him. But in all of the difficulties that confronted Jesus on a regular basis that the scribes and Pharisees attempted to derail him and sidetrack him and test him and make him look silly. And each time the tables were turned, Jesus faced incredible adversity and he met it head on. Did Jesus ever think that his opponent was too formidable? Did Jesus ever run away from or hide from his opponent? Did he ever send a boy out to do a man's job? No, he didn't. You might say, oh, but I remember in the garden where Jesus prayed, if this cup could pass from me. Yes, he did say that. And what did he do? You know when the real battle was won? The war was won in Gethsemane when Jesus got up after praying that prayer and with resolve went to the cross. He knew what he needed to do. He knew he needed to do his Father's will. And he did that. death, a pretty formidable opponent for us, we're all going to face it. And we will not escape it. We will not be as fortunate as Enoch. We will not be as fortunate as Elijah. Unless the Lord comes again, every one of us in this room is going to face death. How did Jesus face death? Resolutely. For the joy set before Him, He endured the cross. The cross wasn't the joy set before Him. What the cross accomplished was the joy set before Him. But He faced death. He looked death in the face. And He said, I'm going to triumph over you. And isn't that what the resurrection is all about? Death was no match for Jesus. The gates of Hades could not hold Him. And He rose the third day. And folks, I'm convinced we need to spend a whole lot more time thinking about the resurrection of Jesus from the dead and the hope of our own resurrection and what courage that will give us in dealing with the things that confront us on a regular basis. We become so short-sighted we forget that God is going to someday raise me from the dead and enable me to spend eternity in His presence, and that fact alone ought to embolden me to deal with the giants of my life. The fact that Jesus was able to do that and defeat death through His resurrection from the dead ought to give me tremendous courage and tremendous strength. Sin was not too formidable a foe for Jesus. Even though Jesus never sinned, He was made sin. According to 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 21, God made Him who had no sin to be sin for us, that we might become the righteousness of God. And yet He was victorious over sin. And we can be victorious over sin. So what is it that you face that brings you dismay or terrifies you, that can compare to Satan and all of his hosts? What is it that you face that is worse than death? What is it that gives you sadness and heartache that can't even begin to compare to what sin and the gates of Hades must have brought to the Son of God? Jesus has dealt with all of these mortal enemies, all of these demons, all of these giants that confront us on a regular basis. And He's done that so that you and I can live now, and not simply live, but live victoriously over all of those kinds of foes. The sin that so easily ensnares us, those weights that encumber us, we can put them off. We can deal with them if we can find a connection to this Christ of God. I'm enthralled with the story of David, and it gives me courage, but it really points me to the story of Jesus and the cross and what has been accomplished there on my behalf. We need to understand that we have one who is greater than David. As a matter of fact, 1 John chapter 4, verse 4 says, "You, dear children, are from God and have overcome them. But the one who is in you is greater than the one who is in the world." Who's in you? Are you a Christian? Then it's Christ who lives in you. And Christ in you enables you in a way that the one who is in the world cannot even begin to enable the world. The one who is in us is greater than the one who is in the world, and as a result, we can what? Overcome. We can defeat the giant that's in front of us. Whatever that giant is, whatever form it takes in your particular life, you can deal with that. This is who we have to fight with us and for us. You don't have a smooth stone in your sling. You have the Rock of Ages. You have the Christ of God to hurl at your giants. Do you believe that? One of the things that have just captured my mind throughout studying for these five lessons is the fact that no matter what I say, no matter what I think about these people we've talked about, one thing is a constant theme in the life of all of them, and that's simply faith. They believe. David believed. The psalmist talks about, David in one of his psalms talks about, I believed, therefore I spoke. One of your giants may be, I can't talk to people about Christ. If you believe, you can. That's the point David makes. Paul quotes him and essentially makes the same argument. If you believe, do you believe? Do you have the faith of David? Do you have the faith of Joshua and of Rahab? Do you have the faith of Deborah and of Barak? Do you have the faith of Gideon? If so, you can deal with the giants in your life. You can tear down the walls that are a distraction. You can overcome all of those difficulties that confront you that may make it impractical or seemingly impractical for you to be one who leads. You can have doubts erased. You can have faith emboldened if you'll come to know who this God is and what this God can do for you. If you're not a Christian, we want to encourage you to get over whatever it is that causes you fear or dismay in becoming a Christian. We want you to, first of all, get over your sin by repenting of it and coming to Christ in faith, being immersed in water and having your sins washed away. Having done that, then live faithfully. Deal with the giants in your life. Defeat them, overcome them. We encourage you, if you're subject to the invitation, to come while we stand and sing.
Just a couple of brief announcements, and then we'll be dismissed and we'll ask John Conrad if he would lead that prayer for us at that time. As most of us know, Sean and Katrina Ayers lost their baby, and she had a surgical procedure late last night, and as things are, I guess they're going as well as could be expected. There's not any difficulty or problems at this time. we do want to remember that family as they continue to overcome this difficulty. Floyd and Salome were here. Salome got nauseous, and so they have left. No connection in the two, but she just wasn't feeling very well, so they did leave a few moments ago. We're grateful for the presence of those who are visiting. Again tonight, as it had been every night this week, we've had a number of visitors from a variety of places, and we're so grateful for your presence and would ask you to return each and every opportunity that you have. If you really want to know how tall 9'6" is, you can step out front. That's Goliath out there, and that's how tall he is. And he's almost 5 feet wide. So you can kind of get a feel for what it is to stand up against a person of that size from that plywood cutout. Thank you very much, and come again as you have every opportunity.